Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Becoming Eisenhower, How Ike Rose from Obscurity to Supreme Allied Commander, by Michael Lee Lanning, narrated by Adam Barr. Introduction. The date was June 6, 1944. The mission was Operation Overlord, to gain a beachhead on the coast of France that would allow the Allies to establish a footing for recapturing occupied Europe and to push inland to defeat Nazi Germany. The commitment was the full might of the greatest military force ever assembled under one command. The land, air, and sea assets of the United States, the United Kingdom, and their allies. At stake was the outcome of World War II on the European front, and possibly the future of the free world. That outcome ultimately rested on the shoulders of one man who possessed the ability to envision and maneuver this grand-scale attack that would change the direction of the war, one man who had the breadth of military knowledge necessary to grasp the complexities of the multidimensional fronts. One man who had the in-depth, hands-on experience to develop and execute air and ground strategies that would overwhelm the enemy. One man who could parlay his charismatic personality into the respect required for others to follow his commands. The one man was General Dwight David Eisenhower. While numerous capable generals were ready and willing to step in to lead the fray, many well-known and highly respected, who might have been placed in this position of such monumental importance, Eisenhower was the only one who had the unique background and tedious training to orchestrate the European operations with such precision and audacity. Unlike the flamboyant General George Patton or the arrogant General Douglas MacArthur, General Eisenhower had been a relatively unknown officer before World War II. In virtual obscurity, he was a man who had spent more than three decades preparing, mostly in inglorious ways, in his and others' view, for his destiny. As a young officer, he tried every avenue available to him to get assigned to Europe before the Great War was over. Instead, he was selected to be a training instructor and post football coach. As a field grade officer, he tirelessly sought to command troops. Instead, he was posted to remote locations to polish his skills in writing and organizing. As a junior general officer, he vied again for troop assignments. Instead, he was too valued by his superiors for release from his desk jobs. Only when the United States was fully committed to war did President Franklin Roosevelt pluck Eisenhower from the upper ranks of the military to make him Supreme Allied Commander, Europe. From this position, Eisenhower issued a message to the troops in the early morning hours of June 6, 1944, that said, in part, "Nothing short of victory is acceptable. Good luck." Thus did he launch the invasion at Normandy on what became known as D-Day, and catapulted his name into the history books as the man who freed Europe. Who was this 56-year-old man who stepped out of the ranks of obscurity to defeat Adolf Hitler's Nazi war machine? I could not have written more than a paragraph or two from memory about Dwight Eisenhower before he caught my attention while I was completing the first drafts of my book on the early career of General George Patton. I knew, of course, that Eisenhower had come to outrank Patton during World War II, and that a plethora of volumes had been written about him both as a general and as a president. Because I had been focusing on the influences that had formed Patton into the soldier he became, I found myself wondering the same about Eisenhower's formative military days. The idea was not, however, my introduction to General and President Dwight Eisenhower. He is the first U.S. president in my memory from my early boyhood. A closer contact came in 1978. My wife Linda and I reported to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas for a short assignment before I entered the Command and General Staff College. We arrived after midnight in a driving snowstorm, and checked into guest quarters in the middle of the post. The next morning, I ventured downstairs from the brick apartment to sunny skies. I noticed a brass plaque next to the apartment store. On brushing off the snow, I discovered that the quarters had been home to Eisenhower and his wife while he attended the same course some 5 decades earlier. After Patton in Mexico went to the publisher, I perused some of the Eisenhower biographies and specialty books looking for information about what and who had been for him major influences early on. I found that the bulk of the published works focus almost exclusively on what happened to him from the time he was appointed Supreme Allied Commander Europe until he died, years after his time at the White House as the 34th President of the United States. While some books included a bit of his boyhood background and others mentioned various early chronological events, none closely examined those critical years that Eisenhower spent as a company-grade or field-grade officer. Those years when soldiers learn the art and craft of leadership through hands-on experience, the operational procedures necessary to strategize the movements of various size units, and the finesse of developing networks among all ranks. In fact, only in Eisenhower's autobiography did I find emphasis on the details of his boyhood and his thoughts and frustrations as he navigated his way from Abilene, Kansas, to the U.S. Military Academy, and from there through the challenging years between the world wars. While I was pleased to have the first-hand information, I am always reluctant, as a historian, to depend on the writers of such books to be totally reliable witnesses. I looked further. My research was basically uncovering a gaping hole in Eisenhower's story, like two bookends standing on either side of a void. Particulars on his family life, childhood, and school experiences were readily available on the one side, as were the details of his successful years as commander and commander-in-chief on the other side. It was the middle, the real story, that held the key to his becoming Eisenhower. That is what I set out to discover, and what I present here in this book as points that are critical to understanding and appreciating the events and people who influenced Dwight Eisenhower. As I pieced together fragments from scores of sources that mentioned in passing events and incidents from those years between Eisenhower accepting his commission from West Point as a second lieutenant and taking the baton to direct operations in the European theater as a 3-star general, I became increasingly intrigued. An airborne Ranger infantry officer with more than 20 years in the Army, I am not easily impressed by desk jockeys who work in tidy offices and sleep between clean sheets every night. In my mind, a real soldier is one who spends time with the troops in the field, getting dirty and tired, and who sleeps in the mud when necessary. So I was not predisposed to become an Eisenhower admirer, assuming from his record of administrative assignments that he had avoided duty in the trenches, most likely through taking advantage of whom he knew. I found studying Eisenhower's life to be an exercise in watching fate at work. When one knows how the story ends, so to speak, reading about Eisenhower's repeated pleas for troop postings and combat assignments is like watching him bang his head against a brick wall, because he cannot see that he is not yet at the corner that will eventually lead his life down unimagined pathways. To follow his formative years of military ambition is to watch him bleed and blunder along on all the endless quests that left him so disappointed, when indeed, to be the leader he would become, he would ultimately call on those very experiences and that very expertise he resented acquiring. Yet as the pieces came together, I began to see what looked more and more like a purposeful pattern to his assignments and to his exposure to the formidable officers for whom he worked and under whose mentorship he had developed. Begrudgingly, I came to appreciate and respect the man who was the result of these influences, a man who spent his life becoming Eisenhower. Michael Lee Lanning, December 2023. Chapter 1. Detours to Greatness. Dwight David Eisenhower arrived at the boot camp for West Point plebes as a young man who had only two real passions. One was to pursue the college degree available to him in exchange for time in service after graduation, which was the only way he could afford this education. The other was sports, especially football and baseball, both of which he excelled at playing. Together with his irresistibly affable personality, he was depending on these qualities and his wits to move him forward in the world. Unlike many of his cadet buddies, Eisenhower had given little to no thought to a military career, nor did he come from a military family with generations of service in its lineage. Neither was his presence there the result of family influence, as his had none. Yet this setting provided the ideal background for Eisenhower to come of age. It allowed him to sort out his priorities as to what was important and what was not, to experiment with resisting authority without dire consequences, and to enjoy the rewards of social connections that would lead to lifelong networks. Eisenhower was a fair-haired boy from America's heartland who had been reared, along with his five brothers, in a hard-working, God-fearing, patriotic family steeped in traditional values. From his earliest days, he charmed those he encountered, from classmates to teachers, from neighbors on his wrong side of the tracks to townspeople on the more prosperous side of his small town of Abilene, Kansas. He was a gregarious, amiable person with an easy way around people, a principled, disciplined leader dedicated to his country, an observant, quiet hero with a sense of humor, and a peace-loving fellow determined to steer America through her path to recovery after World War II and the emerging Cold War. Ike's personality, however, was a double-edged sword. Yes, it made him easy to like, but by making him so acceptable, this trait also made it difficult for him to stand out from the crowd. His agreeable nature made him appear generic and interchangeable. As a result, Eisenhower had to work harder and more diligently than his competitors to gain equal recognition or superiority in his evaluations. That dedication came only with age and maturity, for Dwight David Eisenhower did not distinguish himself as a West Point cadet, graduating from the U.S. Military Academy as number 61 of 164. Although his class would eventually be known as the one that the stars fell on, 59 of the 164 rose to the rank of general officer. No one at the time would have predicted that Eisenhower would ultimately outrank them all. Eisenhower's early years in the Army were equally unremarkable. Even though he entered the service during World War I, he remained stateside for its duration, despite his best efforts to get to the front. Promoted to captain in the Army's World War I expansion, he spent the next 16 years as a major, assigned to desk duty rather than troop command. His only claims to fame as he slowly plodded forward acquiring knowledge and experience were his affable personality, everyone liked him, and his efficient, loyal service to his superiors. He later said, "My ambition in the Army was to make everybody I worked for regretful when I was ordered to other duty." In an exceptional twist of irony, though, his raters at times graded him as only average and good, despite his extraordinary effort and achievements. While those results caused him great disappointment and frustration, they ensured that he found himself in positions where he learned and honed inglorious fundamental skills that would prove essential later in his career. Even when Eisenhower used his social connections to finagle favorable postings, he found himself behind a desk, writing letters and preparing documents, rather than commanding troops. The future general's first assignments were a series of less than desirable postings with responsibilities that he thought offered little opportunity for personal or professional growth. His commanders generally sought his skills as a football coach for the post team rather than his military abilities. Eisenhower remained on the sidelines during World War I as he trained troops in the United States rather than joining a combat unit with the American Expeditionary Force in France. Frustrated with his stateside assignments, he vowed, "By God, from now on I am cutting myself a swath and will make up for this." And he did. As the years passed and assignments changed, Eisenhower worked for and learned from strong leaders, including Frederick Funston, George Patton, Fox Connor, John J. Pershing, Douglas MacArthur, and George Marshall. Each added to Eisenhower's development as an officer and leader, and he continuously displayed a unique ability to get along with all ranks. Ike gained some recognition, at least academically, when he graduated number one in the 1926 class of the Command and General Staff School. He also made an impression as an intelligent, dedicated, efficient subordinate. But again, no one forecast his future successes. At 50 years of age, and after 25 years of service, Eisenhower, with the help of the pre-World War II buildup of the Army, finally reached the rank of Brigadier General in late 1941. He later admitted that he thought he had reached the pinnacle of his career and would advance no further. Again, no one, especially Eisenhower himself, had any idea that in a mere 2 years he would assume command of all Allied forces in Europe. Dwight Eisenhower was the singularly most unlikely candidate for becoming such a powerful figure. No one predicted his destiny as one who would go from a mid-ranking West Point graduate to a five-star general credited with defeating the European Axis powers to save the Western world from tyranny. Yet he did. No one assumed he had the political moxie to go from glorified military clerk to sitting behind the resolute desk in the Oval Office of the White House. But he did. So how did the unassuming, self-sacrificing, nondescript lad walk out of Abilene, Kansas, as a raw kid and into obscurity as a junior officer who spent more than a decade and a half as a mere major in rank? How did this man end up on the world stage as a polished leader who would shape history for generations to come? He took not the road less traveled, but a road of detours that delivered him to greatness. Chapter 2. Iron Cutters to Abilene. The name Eisenhower, translating from German as iron cutter, iron artisan, or iron hewer, was the remnant of a previous time when surnames reflected occupations. The American branch of the Eisenhower family had long since moved on from any iron workings to become farmers and merchants in Middle America. While the search of his family tree could conceivably trace his heritage back to medieval warriors who fought along with Charlemagne in the 8th century, more recent ancestors of the future five-star general commanding the most powerful armed forces of the 20th century were, by contrast, descendants of German Mennonites who immigrated to the United States in the 1740s. Adhering to the Bible and personal conscience, rather than man or government, the group settled in Pennsylvania for several generations along the Susquehanna and became known as the River Brethren. After the Civil War, the Eisenhowers, along with other River Brethren, followed opportunities westward to Abilene in Dickinson County, Kansas, located 20 miles from the geographic center of the country. David Eisenhower, Ike's father, was 15 years old when he accompanied his family on the move west. Although David liked his new home, he took to farming no more in Kansas than he had in Pennsylvania. His father offered him land and money to establish his own farm, as Jacob did with all his children, but David preferred to pursue a career in engineering and mechanics. Instead of working the land, David enrolled in nearby Lane College in September 1883. Lane, founded by the River Brethren, not only encouraged religious education, but also offered its 200 students classes in the liberal arts, as well as vocational training. David studied mechanics and math, along with Greek and speech. It was at Lane that David met Ida Elizabeth Stover, whose family had originally immigrated from the same general area of Europe to Pennsylvania in the 18th century, as had the Eisenhowers. Ida, full of life, vivacious, and charming, grew up in a family that emphasized and believed in pacifism. Ida's mother died when she was 5, and her father soon sent her to live with her maternal grandfather, William Link. Her grandfather opposed her desire for higher education and encouraged her to become a housewife. Instead, Ida left home after high school and made her living cooking for wealthy couples before teaching in a one-room schoolhouse. She did not set aside her Bible study, however, but rather memorized more than 1,000 verses. When Ida reached the legal age of 21, she used her inheritance from her now-deceased father to join several of her brothers in their move to Kansas. Ida briefly lived with a brother in Lecompton before entering Lane College to study music and liberal arts. In the fall of 1884, David and Ida began courting. Their relationship was a classic example of the attraction of opposites. David was temperamental, self-absorbed, and stubborn, with little sense of humor. By contrast, Ida was vivacious, outgoing, and optimistic. Differences aside, the couple dropped out of Lane and married on September 23, 1885. Both showed their independence, with David making plans to open a business and Ida using the last of her inheritance to purchase a piano, a possession she would treasure for the remainder of her life. Financed by his father, David opened a general store in Hope. Despite his tenacity, he lacked business skills and took on Milton Good, a former Abilene haberdashery salesman, as a partner. Both the Good family and the Eisenhowers lived in apartments above the store. The merchant pair never got along well, David finding neither satisfaction nor profit in the retail trade. After 18 months, he borrowed more money from his father and purchased Good's interest in the business. The November 5, 1886 edition of the Hope Dispatch reported their partnership had been dissolved, with Good being released from all responsibilities of the late firm. However, according to family legend, Good stole the store's cash and left in the middle of the night. It is not known whether David and Ida's son Dwight, who later wrote in support of this story, believed the theft occurred or was deliberately defending his father's reputation. In reality, Good did not flee Hope to parts unknown with the store's money, as the Eisenhowers claimed. Instead, he moved back to Abilene, where he became involved in the town's administration, and in 1892 opened a dry goods store. With Good's departure, David's younger brother, Abraham Lincoln, so named because his father so admired the president, joined in the ownership of the store, which the pair renamed Eisenhower Brothers. Abraham, a Brethren preacher and veterinarian, was as jovial and outgoing as his brother was somber. David lost interest in being a businessman, and in October 1888 turned the store over to his brother, who renamed it A.L. Eisenhower and Company. With no desire to rejoin the family farming businesses, David left Ida, now pregnant with their second son, in Hope, and ventured about 400 miles south to Denison, Texas, a town established in 1872 with the arrival of the Missouri-Kansas-Texas Railroad, known as the Katy. The Katy was the town's principal employer, and David took a job in the rail roundhouse as an oil wiper, the man who packed every moving part of the locomotives with grease and then wiped away the excess. In this position, at the bottom of the railroad job hierarchy in prestige, as well as pay, David worked mostly 12-hour shifts. In April 1889, Ida, with her newborn son Edgar and his older brother Arthur, joined David in Denison. She left her beloved piano behind in Kansas with friends, in hopes of someday returning. The Eisenhowers rented a modest wood-frame house near the railroad tracks just east of what is today U.S. Highway 75. On October 14, 1890, Ida, in the midst of a violent thunderstorm, gave birth at home to their third son, who they named David Dwight, in honor of his father and Dwight Lyman Moody, an internationally famed evangelist and religious writer. There was no formal birth certificate at the time. An entry in the family Bible sufficed, as it did for all the Eisenhower children. Shortly after this baby's birth, Ida became concerned that her son would be called David Jr., or nicknamed Dave. To guard against this outcome, Ida simply reversed the first two names to Dwight David, something she had done as a young girl with her own original name of Elizabeth Ida. In 1891, Jacob Eisenhower visited Texas and was appalled at the conditions David and his family were living in. He provided money for them to purchase their own house, but deciding his son lacked financial management skills, insisted that the property be registered in Ida's name. Still, Jacob repeatedly encouraged his son to return to Kansas. When the couple could no longer avoid admitting defeat in Texas, David, Ida, Arthur, Edgar, and Dwight made their way northward, after more than 3.5 years in Denison, back to Abilene. There they rented a small shack with virtually no yard until David's brother decided he wanted to leave the area and offered to sell them his two-story house. Dwight was only 10 months old when the family left Texas. He later visited Denison a few times, returning in 1946, when the town acquired and refurbished his parents' old home in his honor, in 1952 as a stop in his presidential campaign, and in 1965 to dedicate the Denison High School Eisenhower Auditorium. Dwight had no recollection of his brief childhood in Denison and no allegiance to his birthplace. Beyond his listing it as his place of birth and later learning to make recipes his mother acquired there, Texas had no impact on him. For the rest of his life, he often said, "The proudest thing I can claim is that I am from Abilene." The Abilene in which Eisenhower grew up had unpaved roads and wooden planks for sidewalks, a single policeman as its law enforcer, religion as its dominant influence, and a caste system demarcated by the Union Pacific Railroad tracks, which divided the haves on the north side from the have-nots on the south. Among the have-nots were Dwight's parents, David and Ida, who focused their priorities as they believed best for their family and as evidenced when Dwight reflected on his childhood, writing, "Mother and father maintained a genuine partnership in raising their 6 sons. Father was the breadwinner, Supreme Court, and Lord High Executioner. Mother was tutor and manager of our household." He added, "I never heard a cross word pass between them. They never argued over family, social, or economic affairs." At the same time, he continued, "they were not demonstrative in their love for each other, but a quiet, mutual devotion permeated our home. This had a lasting effect on all the boys." David spent most of his time at work as a general maintenance man making minimum wage at a new branch of the Bell Springs Creamery and had little to do with the raising of his 6 sons. Dwight later observed, "Mother was by far the greatest personal influence on our lives." Thus, in that setting and in that family, Dwight spent his formative years. Both David and Ida hoped for a girl as their family grew, but each new birth brought another son, with the arrival of Roy in 1892, Earl in 1898, and Milton in 1899. A 7th baby, Paul, born in 1894, died at the young age of 10 months from diphtheria. The boys all had chores both outside and inside the home. Ida, with no daughters, made the boys help with the cleaning, laundry, and cooking, as well as caring for the animals and tending the garden. Dwight particularly took to the kitchen and enjoyed cooking for the rest of his life. In 1898, David bought from his brother Abraham a large 2-story wood frame house with a barn and fruit orchard on 3 acres, located at 201 Southeast 4th Street. Little could anyone have imagined that the property would one day be known as the home of the Dwight Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum. At the time, though, the purpose of the purchase was to bring stability to a family that had been seeking its rightful place. The new home and grounds included space for a milk cow, chickens, ducks, and pigs. A large garden plot provided fresh vegetables, as well as enough to be canned for winter consumption. Ike later recalled that potatoes were the most prolific crop, appearing on the table for nearly every meal. A horse pulled a garden plow as well as the family wagon. Except for having to purchase flowers.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?